Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources, or check out all the original writing on our site at subchina.com, including reported stories, editorials, regular columns, a growing library of videos, and, of course, our podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim people in China's Xinjiang region to China's ambitious efforts to eliminate poverty. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This week, I welcome back Adam Tooze, professor of history at Columbia University. Adam, as those of you who heard him last time, I guess it was last year, will recall, was trained as a Germanist and is really known for his chops as an economic historian. He's written a number of excellent books, including The Wages of Destruction on the Economy of the Third Reich, Crashed, which remains, for my money, the best book on the global financial crisis, and The Great Deluge, which looks at the First World War and the interwar period. But the reason I've asked Adam on to Cynica today is that last month he published an excellent essay in The New Statesman, specifically about China. It was titled, Why There Is No Solution to Our Age of Crisis Without China, which may be a bit of a misleading title in that it actually has relatively little that's focused on the need to work with China to address, you know, the usual litany of things that we, well, obviously need to work with China on: global warming and deadly pandemics and non-proliferation and, you know, the overall health of the global economy. Instead, it's a much more ambitious essay, and we will dissect it at some length in what follows. Adam Tooze, welcome back to Cynica.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, when I wrote to you to ask you to do another turn on the show, you mentioned that you had approached the assignment that you'd gotten from your editor with a little bit of trepidation. You know, why not ask a China specialist or an expert to write it? Let me say, first of all, that I'm glad that you did step up, because I, for one, really value the perspectives of intelligent people from outside of the China field, because inside the field, you know, people can be very narrowly specialized, and they often miss the forest for the trees, and they get, you know, tangled up in these little sort of insider debates. They often also lack a comparative historical perspective, which is something that I want to talk about at some length. And they fail to engage often with, you know, the really big questions because, well, they're just too big. So what ultimately made you decide to tackle this assignment and write this essay?
Well, a sense of obligation, because I agree with you. I mean, I think in the same way as I would welcome a China specialist giving us his or her take on the situation in Europe, for instance, I feel we kind of owe it to each other to reach out and to make that effort of synthesis and synthetic understanding. That was very much the spirit in which I approached the history of China at the first moment I did, which was writing about the book Deluge and the aftermath of World War One, or the history of World War One itself. I mean, no one's ever going to mistake me for a China specialist. But on the other hand, it's clearly time for us all from our own particular vantage points to make that leap. And so that was really, in the end, what motivated me. Plus again and again and again, simply curiosity. I mean, one of the great advantages of reading and writing and researching as a non-specialist is that you've not reached the point of diminishing returns.
Right.
So the cognitive gains to new reading and new learning for me from doing that are much greater in some way than they are from revisiting the troubled history of the European integration project or something like that. Not that I don't do that regularly. So those were the reasons. And it's simply, and finally, I think, you know, I do feel, like so many other people concerned with the West's relationship with China, a sense of urgency in this moment. And the piece is not in any way apologetic, but it is an effort at understanding. It is an effort to try and represent the rise of the Chinese economy, not as, you know, something primarily that's menacing or that should concern us because it's a matter of overtaking, but to represent, as it were, the story of China's troubled and repeated efforts, iterative efforts, really, to achieve modernity, to achieve prosperity, and to put that also in the context of the violent history of the region.
Absolutely.
And that ultimately, I think, you know, trying to put across that version of events rather than the sort of simple story that goes from GDP to defense budgets to, you know, a challenge to American hegemony, which is so prevalent at the moment, that was also a concern.
So it was actually in your researches for the Deluge that you sort of encountered Versailles and the May 4th movement and really kind of, you know, the central piece of modern intellectual history. So that was a very good entree, a really good entry point for you into. As I said, this is a really ambitious essay. So just for those of our listeners who haven't yet read it, and by the way, it isn't very long, so I suggest that you hit pause and you read it now. Just Google Adam Tooze, New Statesman, China, and it will come up. For those of you who can't read it right now, let me just give a quick outline of what Adam has tried to do with the essay. Adam, you can correct me if I've gotten any of this wrong, but maybe we can do this because it'll be maybe more economical. So you set out first to give a sense on the occasion of the Communist Party's 100th anniversary of the scale of its accomplishments. You do this very quickly, and how its successes really challenged these long-cherished Whiggish beliefs about the final triumph of liberalism. And then you frame up kind of right-sizing exercise, I would describe it as, where you offer your own answer to what basically everyone is trying to figure out, which is, you know, what are China's actual ambitions? And you hint that they lie somewhere between the kind of unthreatening quiescence of the hide and bide period, the 1990s and the early 2000s, and this full-blown sort of, you know, ideologically or even existentially threatening aggression that you just talked about of, you know, the hawk's fevered imaginations. So far, so good, right?
I mean, that's the setup. Okay. No, I do think that is an essential first move, right? I mean,
yeah.
And also, I mean, just to position it against, say, America's own, you know, extraordinary. I mean, without making a normative judgment, nevertheless, historically unprecedented claim, I think.
Right? Yeah, to, absolutely.
In the full light of day, strike at, in the mode of personal assassination, antagonists that it declares, you know, outside the law and fair game, if you think about, you know, senior figures in the military leadership of Iran are just struck dead on airport runways by drone attack. China's not in that game.
Yeah, we will talk about that great paragraph where you write what China is not. But let me move through the essay. So I'll go on. In search of an answer to that right-sizing question, you then, I think, turn very wisely to China's history to see what that can tell us. And you dispense first with some historical analogies, one, you know, that's based on this idea of the Thucydides trap, which is recently so popular, specifically, you know, the Wilhelmine German analogy. And, you know, you being a Germanist, that makes a lot of sense. We'll talk about that in a bit. And you invoke, I thought it was fascinating, this figure who I'd only heard of in connection with his work Imperialism, and only then because, you know, it had been kind of influential on Lenin, J.A. Hobson, who was a British economist. And that was fascinating, I thought. I mean, first of all, where did you stumble on this quote where, you know, he really talked about how, you know, China was going to be a major determinant, if not the major determinant of the future of mankind? He said, whatever it does, whether it becomes a fragmented power, whether it's vanquished, whether it's absorbed or becomes, you know, a state standing on its own two feet, it's going to be the big determinant. Where did you come across Hobson and what other gems of wisdom may be hidden in there about China?
Well, I mean, Hobson is well known as the inspirer of Lenin.
Right.
Lenin's quite frank about it.
Right.
And Hobson is also an immediate precursor to Keynes, both in his economics and in his internationalism. And so he is, you know, the key representative before Keynes of, you know, the political intellectual tradition which I personally feel attached to, which is left liberalism of the British variety. You know, you can hear from my accent, that's where I'm born. And so he's thinking through that the fundamental dilemmas really of the late 19th century, and he's crucial, and he opens the door to Lenin because he blows open any kind of liberal Panglossian kind of optimism about everything being right in the world, and says, well, no, the consequences of economic growth are precisely the sorts of everything you're familiar with from Lenin,
right,
is actually already in Hobson, including the economics and the analysis of capital flows. And Hobson is thinking about two great, as it were, cauldrons of conflict at the moment of the turn of the century. And one of them is, coming from a British point of view, South Africa and the Boer War, which he sees as an absolutely classic, you know, cauldron of imperialist antagonism. And if you have to understand, for somebody like him, empire is, broadly speaking, thought of in normatively positive terms.
Right.
Empire is a source of universal order. It's a form of legal structure that can encompass, you know, broad spans of territory around the world. And when he's writing about imperialism, he thinks of imperialism as the antithesis of empire, because imperialism is land-grabbing, aggressive, destabilizing, rivalrous, competitive, disorderly, and leads to war. And what he's diagnosing, what he's trying to shake the British elite awake over, is the fact that their Victorian hegemony, their mid-19th century, 1850s, 1860s, opium wars, period of unrivaled dominance, where coming off the Napoleonic Wars, the British bestrode the world, is under threat. And it's under threat from all sides, the Italians, the Germans, the Japanese, the Russians, the Americans. And it's that situation that we have to understand. So it's a theory of crisis of globalization of the first generation. And on one part of that is South Africa, where you have the Germans dabbling, and the other is China.
Right.
And he's writing in the immediate context of the Boxer Uprising. And it's not by accident that China becomes the laboratory for thinking not, as it were, particular types of aggression. Though obviously the Chinese, for instance, single out the Japanese as their obvious natural antagonists at certain moments. But as it were, imperialism in general, because in China around the Boxer Rebellion, you do see this extraordinary convergence of all of the imperialist powers in a strike.
And also an absolute uncertainty of outcome. I mean, it could have gone any of these paths. It could have been fragmented. It could have been vanquished. Yeah.
It could have, or as it were, and what Hobson sees heaving into view on the horizon is the possibility that it could actually be consolidated around a national core.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does that, just looking at the bulk of it, it's evident that it changes the game, then it changes the game at the global level, because it will then be the mightiest state structure the world has ever seen. And so he maps this out. So it goes from a very general analysis of the problems of liberalism. People like Michael Pettis and Matt Klein have taken up to underpin their thinking about the imbalances of the global economy 100 years later to a rather particular analysis of the central role of China. And this, for me, thinking about China is always the problem, right? Does it subsume under broad, what we think of as broader categories? Or, does that basically misunderstand the geography of the world? Because we're used in the West to generalizing from lots of small country cases.
Right.
And what you do when you all of a sudden have this thing, which is one-sixth of humanity, in and of itself, progressing, developing, doing whatever it does, right? And Hobson, for me, is one of the first thinkers in the West in the modern period who really tangled squarely with that. And his conclusion was unambiguous. The whole game will be decided there, fundamentally.
Right. So then in the piece, you do something that I thought was really bold and, for my money, deftly executed. It was a potted history of China from the First Opium War to Xi Jinping's ascent. And I have to say, it was surprisingly well done. I mean, you being you, of course, you linger longer in more detail on some economic turning points, the economic history. But, you didn't leave out anything that was too important. And you remind us, as I've often reminded people on this program, that the turning point, when you get, later on in the history, we can go back into some of this history, but the turning point in the U.S.-China relationship predated Trump. It predated even Xi. And if you had to fix a date on it, the year 2009 would be a good choice. And I completely concur. I mean, I have been arguing that for a very long time on this program. You remind us of what China also is not. And like I said, we will talk about this. And these few sentences really pack quite a big punch, I thought. And again, we will talk about this. Then, just as importantly, you list the various things that Beijing has done or that still does do that are very much rankle. These things, as you know, are, though, what a large, assertive nation state does. And that's another pin I want to, drop in there. And let's talk about a nation state. you remind us, you know, for its sheer size, the ambition of its ruling party, that China is not an ordinary nation state. Then you raise what is, I think, maybe the most intriguing question about China's rise. And it's one that rarely gets asked candidly. Well, it's never really posed or satisfactorily answered, at least by American politicians. And you quote Larry Summers here, and who asked in 2018, can the U.S. imagine a viable global economic system in which the U.S. is no longer the dominant player? Could an American political leader acknowledge that reality in a way that permits negotiation over what such a world would look like? To which the answer right now, I mean, it comes from Joe Biden, is not on my watch. So then just to wrap up our little summary. So then finally, to drive home what's at stake, you raise an issue that you talked about in some of your earlier writings, you know, the centrality of China to addressing global warming. And finally, there's this, I guess, you know, in your own, it's your own words, but it's a kind of recapitulation of this Larry Summers theme, and it's in the penultimate paragraph. And this is what really did it for me. This was the money quote. You wrote, "It is not clear that American politics can digest plurality other than from a position of dominance," before going on to hint that, no, American politics cannot digest plurality from a position of parity or non-dominance. So with that outline done, there are just all sorts of questions I've got for you, but let's start with this. Historical analogies, right? It's handy that you, being a Germanist, you know, and since the analogies that get trotted out most frequently are, you know, the German analogies. You gave an interview to a Chinese newspaper called, the paper, Penghai, in which you were asked about historical analogies and specifically about this oft-cited, you know, Thucydides' trap example of the Anglo-German relationship in the run-up to the Great War, you know, after basically between, you know, Bismarck's Germany after the Franco-Prussian War. And you were dismissive of that, as you were in the same New Statesman piece, although, you know, just very quickly you dismissed it out of hand. What do we get wrong when we lean on these historical analogies? What does it mislead or what does it obscure?
Well, you get First World War wrong, first of all. You get 1914 wrong. The Thucydides trap logic may not be a bad way of thinking about World War One, but it is not the Anglo-German antagonism that drives it. The one that really does matter is the German-Russian antagonism. Mm. So that's, you know, that's the sort of historian in me. It's like, you know, we might as well be talking the right thing. But Russia is the swing variable. Because the war is a ground war, it's a land war, right? And what drives the German soldiers is the concern about the Franco-Russian. So Kennan was right. The Franco-German, George Kennan, you know, the great analyst of American foreign policy, of a distinctly, you know, had a problematic relationship with Russia, shall we say. But his understanding that the relationship between Republican France and Tsarist Russia was the sort of, you know, the worm in the apple of pre-1914 international relations, I think, is broadly speaking correct. It messes everything up, right? Because you've got a French Republic aligned with an autocratic Tsarism, which is very unstable, but also very dynamic economically. And that does everyone's heads. Like, progressive Germans don't know which way to align, because should you take a defeatist position, surrender, but then you end up surrendering to the Tsar, you know. Anyway, so that is, that's the first problem.
Right.
The Anglo-German antagonism in and of its own right was probably capable of being mediated. And the Anglo-American antagonism, after all, which does take place at the level of the global arena, the naval arena, is mediated. You know, because the Thucydides trap only takes you so far. But, you know, people like Lenin and Trotsky were convinced that, and Hitler as well, that the United States and Britain would inevitably end up at odds on Thucydides' trap logic. In other words, how could the British, you know, imperial elite not fight the United States for supremacy? And the answer is because they're not crazy.
Right.
Because they could see the problem coming, because they could see the advantages of buddying up to the United States, which through to the late 1960s, I was just talking about this with somebody else, until the late 1960s, Britain is the hegemonic military power in the Middle East, not the United States. And it's being held there by the Americans. So through to 67, right?
Right.
So that was the bargain, and it worked very well for the British elite, right? And after World War One, they were clear they could not afford an antagonism or even the prospect of that. So that's another reason why the Thucydides trap, you misspecify 1914. The one that really does matter is the one between the British and the Americans. That's resolved peacefully. But the third objection for me is simply again, it's like, does China fit into categories designed for smaller, historically, in some ways, in world historic terms, less significant antagonisms? I mean, let's remind ourselves, this is, you know, it comes out of Sparta and Athens, two microscopic little European city-states, right, you know, over 2,000 years ago. And we generalize out to the British Empire, admittedly a giant world historic force. The Kaiserreich, not, right? It's a local, regional reconfiguration of the European power balance. And all of a sudden, we're now using that to read a 21st century encounter between an American global superpower, which is historically unprecedented in its reach and its might, and China. 1/6 of humanity mobilized in a way that no group of humanity has ever been mobilized before in economic terms. We've literally never, ever, in the record of, you know, of human experience, had anything like the ascent of China over the last 30, 40 years. So I just think, you know, I would not want to wager any significant money on this as a way of thinking about this. Plus, of course, we know it's internalized. I mean, Xi Jinping himself has referred to this model and said how dangerous it is. So we've also got like years, decades, hundreds of years, in fact, of reflection on this as a way of analysing the world. So for all of those reasons, it's present. At this point, there's no point in denying it. You can't wish it out of the world. But I wouldn't, as it were, want to anchor an understanding, right, on that as a hardwired determinative logic.
So the 4th century BC Peloponnese maybe isn't our most instructive example.
Right? Well, I mean, only Western, you know, a classical education of a Western civ variety might make that compelling to you if you're continuously in the game of projecting yourself back to the Peloponnese. But I mean, I didn't have the benefit of that kind of education. Maybe that's one reason why it's just not compelling to me. I'm sorry, I'm too much of a barbarian to like to even be able to get my head in that place.
I do like reading my landmark Thucydides and my landmark Herodotus. Those are great volumes to own. But anyway, there's another, maybe even more freighted analogy that gets trotted out as well. And you know, the other German analogy, you've heard it before, you know, before the Beijing Summer Games in 2008. This is Berlin, 1936. Even more now, with, you know, even more explicit references and more people making the suggestion that China today is an example of a mature fascist state. Now, I studied with A. James Greger at UC Berkeley, so I think I know, yeah, I know from fascism enough to say this ain't it. But what do you say to people who insist on the applicability of the label to the modern PRC, that it's fascist?
Yeah, and I do get asked that because I have this background, doesn't it? I mean, I get quite cross, to be honest. I mean, I think it's pejorative. I mean, it's just flat out pejorative. And yeah, so I mean, that's my first reaction. I mean, it's a misunderstanding of the nature of this problem. I mean, and it has a long lineage, that kind of pejorative liberal argument. And and you know, much as I would self-identify as a left liberal, you know, it's important to recognize the weakness of one's own tradition, if you like, and the politics often associated with it. And one of its, as it were, stupider sides is that it flattens its antagonists, right? So when liberals come up against something they recognize as illiberal, they're terribly tempted to say, oh, well, you know, therefore it's totalitarian or fascist. And this is, to my mind, a profoundly unhelpful way of engaging with a much more complex reality, and a reality which is massively path-dependent. I know you have very strong views about the nature of the ideological project which the Communist Party in China is still engaged in. And this is in no way to exculpate, right? Again, another one of these sort of liberal weaknesses is to say, well, if you're saying that, you must be downplaying the murderousness. Don't you understand that tens of millions of people were killed? And of course, the answer is no. Death is not the same as politicide, it's the same as politicize. They are all in their own ways, of course, you know, horrific. And being a privileged citizen of the West, never having been on the receiving end of that, I speak about all of these experiences with due modesty, because who are we to sit here and pontificate about the kind of violence that a regime like that can and dish out and does dish out? But it is clearly not the same in so many different ways. I mean, there's no equivalent in the history of the Chinese Communist Party's history to the Holocaust. Nor is there any equivalent to, you know, Operation Barbarossa, within which the Holocaust was fully nested after 1941. Mm-hmm. This is an absurd comparison.
Right.
So I think it derives from either a polemical intent, of which there's plenty around right now, or it derives from a really kind of flaccid and flat kind of liberal demonization of illiberal enemies and just this simplifying and unhelpful schematics.
Let's talk a little bit about your potted history of China. First, I'm really curious, when you set out to write this, what did you turn to? What books, what resources did you consult? I mean, who did you run your draft account by? I mean, I'm curious about why, you know, what sources you would have regarded as sufficiently authoritative, since, you know, some of the stuff is still pretty hotly contested. What was your process?
Oh, Lord. This might not be a bit that you may want to cut this out. I mean, the way I constructed it, right, is that it's organized around a series of ideas. So it's organized around a series of, you know, the idea being that the process of Chinese economic modernization is iterative and it involves a series of bounds, a series of efforts. Part of the argument of the piece is, after all, that one of the misleading features of the invocation of the Thucydides trap at this moment is the idea that it's new, right? That this is something we've suddenly run into. Whereas I think a more balanced account of China's national political history, and I understand that's a problematic term when applied to China, because you could think of it as empire or civilizational. But in any case, let's just say that part of the project here is the making of China as a nation state. This has run up against repeated obstacles. If we were in a Thucydides trap situation, in other words, this would not be the first time.
Right.
And that is, in fact, absolutely internal to the self-understanding of, well, the Communist Party regime in the current moment, is that it is the heir to a history of contested, violently contested struggles. And some of those are external, right? Starting with the Boxer Rebellion in the late 19th century, going through, you know, the humiliating interactions with Japan during World War I, culminating in May 4th. But then even more dramatically in the 1930s, because I do read, and this is, as it were, based on, you know, various people's analyses of Japanese elite thinking, I do read this basic driver of Japanese aggression towards China in the 20s and 30s, above all in the 30s, as being the effort to anticipate and forestall the consolidation of a potent national republican regime on the mainland of China, which would fundamentally, as it has done in due course, alter Japan's position in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, the other source of tension are internal to China. So divisions within China, classically, of course, in the so-called warlord period, but then also within the period of Maoism, with this, you know, really unique in the history of global developmentalism, violent antagonism between projects of state building, which are instantly recognizable to anyone who knows the history of the Soviet Union, on the one hand, and the Maoist project of bottom-up, you know, bombarding the headquarters, this sort of insurgent notion of revolutionary politics, which is, you know, which is the bit which is, I think, from a Western historian's point of view, hardest to understand in its potency, right? Continuing potency through to the 1970s. And so that's what the piece tries to lay out as the backdrop to the much more, I think, for a contemporary audiences, more familiar story of, you know, reform since the late 70s and the drive on from there.
Yeah, and I mean, you did an excellent job of making that relevant, I mean, and making the case for why it's important to understand both this external and these you know, internal forces. So, I mean, China's history is often said to be daunting, and certainly all the more so for someone, you know, without a steeping in the language and in the culture and whatnot. But I've often said, and I remember when a really good friend of mine and I were talking about exactly this question one night over beers in Beijing, is that, you know, all you really need to know to develop a basic appreciation for how that history has shaped the worldviews of Chinese people alive today, you can learn it in an afternoon. Less, actually. I mean, you just kind of provided in a nutshell right there. The broad contours of that history are just not all that complex. And while historians would certainly balk at this kind of squashed down, oversimplified narrative that I'm talking about, it is the version that Chinese people have learned and internalized for many decades now. And, you know, and for that reason alone, it's really, you know, important to know how they think about their own history. apart from maybe, you know, the CCP's starring role in the eventual victory over Japan, the rest is, you know, close enough to factual that it goes largely unchallenged, right? So you were able to give, like I said just now, a pretty decent overview, and you certainly did so in the essay. And that suggests to me that you don't think your intended audience maybe yet has a grasp of the basics of Chinese history, on how understanding the country's history has shaped its values, its priorities, its behaviors, its institutions. So what did compel you to include a relatively detailed overview that takes two-thirds of your essay? What was the reason why you decided, I need to educate this readership on the outlines of Chinese history?
Because I think it is crucial that we have this outline in our heads, right? That we should understand it. And I don't take the elements to be entirely unproblematic, and as it were, emphasizing the bits that I do in the way that I do is intended to make in each case, you know, a point. I mean, not a polemical point, but certainly to make a point. So, you know, the sort of move to rehabilitate the warlords as actors in a story of national modernization is important, I think, to impart to a Western audience who just generally has a sort of Tintin conception of that period of Chinese history, or sort of J.G. Ballard, filtered through those, you know, it's a sort of exotic view of Shanghai, and then the Japanese come in from the outside. So putting that element in the picture, I also think for me, conveying to a Western audience the way in which economic growth per se is a relatively, as it were, novel idea as a consolidating, you know, that the focus under Deng on the development of the forces of production per se as a project, under which one can read in Marxist terms after all. I mean, it takes you back to the Menshevik kind of position, that or a Stalinist position, depending on which way you want to read it, that is something that has, as it were, to be inserted into the DNA of government in China in the late 1970s, rehabilitated. That's an idea, I think, which again takes people by surprise, because they're not, you know, they think of Maoism as sort of the mad project of, you know, of this extraordinary individual. They think of it as murderous. They think of, you know, lots of young people running around in blue suits and waving little red books. But then I don't think there isn't really a kind of deep appreciation of the radical intent of that politics. I mean, once upon a time, of course, large numbers of Europeans in particular were infatuated with it. But it's largely absent from the conversation in the present day. You know, it's remembered perhaps obliquely by way of ghastly, you know, the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia, which of course is not what's going on in China, but related to it. And so I think that those making those sorts of elemental moves is absolutely a worthwhile essay. Well, I hope it is anyway. Like, you know, as an author, you put your bottle out on to the sea and see whether it lands anywhere. And this does seem to have resonated with people, because it's you know, it's in the manner of this kind of sketching of history, the selectivity is radical, but sometimes as a result of that, you end up with a rather bold caricature. And I think in policymaking terms as well, that having the right kind of bold caricature in your head is crucial. I'm a big believer in, you know, what Nikki Caldor, the veteran Keynesian economist, called stylized facts. Ideas, nuggets to think with and to, you know, position on your intellectual chessboard.
The mission statement of chart book.
In many ways, it might have been useful.
We'll talk about that. So indulge me in a little rant here. I just want your reaction to it. No specific question. But I find that even if you teach someone, even in some depth, the history of a country, and it doesn't have to be China, it can be, you know, in any other country, that in itself just is never enough. Back in my days, and I was an aspiring academic and I was teaching undergrads in the 1990s, I found that their knowledge of Western history was just appallingly shallow. And even if they could tick off, you know, the names and dates and the battles and the treaties and what have you, they hadn't really thought about European or American history enough. So often, you know, even I was trying to teach Chinese history, I found their thinking to be just so shot through with, you know, teleology and just no appreciation whatsoever for the contingency that's so inherent in history. And as I've doubtless, you know, said this before on the show in different contexts, but, you know, I think many of us, and this is especially true after the collapse of Soviet communism, you know, in this kind of moment of triumphalism, in this this kind of moment of grand amnesia, historical amnesia, where we just kind of checked out and we found ourselves standing on this side of this yawning historical chasm. And we look across and we see Russia and Iran and China and India, you know, the nations of the Arab world. And we say, come on over, you know, be like us, right? Just cross the chasm. It's super easy. Or if you're Neil Ferguson, you might just say, you know, just download these killer apps of Western civilization and you can be just like us. But, you know, of course, we don't bother to look down into that chasm and see all the bodies strewn along the path that took us here, all the skin of the teeth escapes and those lucky rolls of the dice that got us here. We act as if it were, you know, preordained or easy when it's absolutely neither. And so, you know, all these tensions that had to either resolve one way or another or not be resolved, as the case may be, you know, that allowed us to develop concepts like, you know, rule of law or separation of powers or this belief in the, you know, sovereign primacy of the individual. You know, this blindness, this amnesia is just incredibly frustrating. I feel like people who do, though, understand the contingency that's inherent in history and who do have an appreciation for the massive gravitational force of history and for the historical privilege that makes our careless ahistoricism even possible. These people just they have a different approach when it comes to a non-Western country like China. I mean, and, you know, it's like, so part of what's so daunting to me is not getting them to understand the contours of China's century of humiliation, but to understand something about their own privilege and you know, to cure them of the Whiggish teleological bullshit.
I mean, it may help in that case that I grew up between England, which was at the time, or Britain at the time, a declining, you know, an empire, an ex-empire in a state of crisis. I mean, that was very shaped by the experience of Britain in the 1970s. And on the other hand, West Germany, which at the time was still the front line in the Cold War, one element of a formerly unified country that, when I got there, was only, you know, 30 years away from the end of World War II, less than 30 years away from the end of World War II. And the scars literally on the bodies of the older folk when you went to the swimming pools, of which Germany has many in the summer, were literally just in front of your eyes. I mean, wow. You could, you know, people's old dudes in Speedos with huge chunks of their bodies missing from shrapnel and machine gun bursts. And so I think that, you know, and then, you know, in my lifetime, I've sort of, as everyone else, but I mean, I think I've just been extremely conscious of the way in which those envelopes, as it were, of what at the time appeared to be a frozen and stable world have continuously shifted. German unification, Brexit most recently. I think we might very well witness the disintegration of the United Kingdom over the next 10 to 20 years. And de facto, we already are. So that sense for me is very, you know, deeply intuitive. And I think working my way through German history as I started by doing professionally and thinking very hard about the way in which they too have had to, as it were, you know, not so much as it were shape a narrative of the centuries of humiliation, but the sort of century of aggression and disaster, and understanding what that meant, the contingency also of the idea of the nation in the German case, which has come into its own even in my own lifetime. And when I go back and visit now, my friends of my age, I'm in my 50s, they'll say to me, you know, Adam, we don't talk about the Federal Republic anymore. It's all Germany.
Right.
But growing up in West Germany, as I did in the 70s and 80s, no one, certainly of a liberal disposition, spoke of Germany. You spoke of the Bundesrepublik, the Federal Republic, which is what, you know, the state that you were proud to be part of. So even, you know, in these subtle ways, even in the course of my lifetime, in a zone, as you're saying, of immense privilege and stability, basically, you if you have your ear to the ground and you're attuned to it, you can feel this shifting terrain.
You know, it's so frustrating here. I can not imagine an educated or reasonably, you know, liberal white American today saying to a Black Lives Matter activist or to somebody pushing for reparations, hey, slavery ended 150 years ago, get over it. Or that same person saying, you know, the memory of slavery is being kept alive through Democratic Party propaganda and the public school system that, you know, that party dominates through, you know, critical race theory. Or that, you know, Black Americans, you're indulging a narrative of victimization. I mean, you don't need to accept that China's historical experiences are directly comparable to the trauma of enslaved Americans to understand that history matters, and that whether you're German and you have, you know, the whole trauma of the second of both wars in the interwar period, history really matters, and it lives beyond lifetimes. Granted, I think Americans today learn much more about the experience of their black compatriots than they do, say, about China. But they learn, or at least my kids, you know, going to public schools in the American South, they learn about the lasting legacy of white supremacy in our institutions, in the property market, in education, in the job market. But is it such a leap to be able to extend that same kind of appreciation for historical experiences to a country like China or to Iran or to Russia, especially, you know, given that, like I think we've argued and we both agree, the broad contours aren't that difficult to grasp.
Hmm. Well, I don't think, I mean, it is clearly not too much to demand intellectually, but I think the problem presumably is politics. Because there is a substantial body of opinion in the United States which would absolutely take the position that you and I think would both think was obnoxious.
Right. But what I'm complaining about is that I don't expect them to be able to you know, grasp China's experience, but I do expect them, the people on our side, the left liberals.
But I think generalizing is difficult. We do have to reckon with, I would have thought, the continued force of, you know, communist history. I mean, this isn't any old regime advocating this adopting this position. I mean, America has a checkered history of dealing with post-colonial or anti-colonial nationalisms, including with Chinese. I mean, the Americans did not exactly rally around Sun Yat-sen's flag, did they?
Yeah.
They were slow to move to the position of backing Chiang Kai-shek. The British, as imperialists, were much quicker to move to a recognition of the necessity of doing a deal with the Chinese. They had much more at stake as well. I mean, America's position in China in the 20s is largely a matter of fantasy compared to the sorts of investments the British, the French, the Japanese have along the coast. So I do think actually America has, you know, oscillates between a sort of romantic affection for certain sorts of national republicanism around the world, including the Chinese project at various moments, but then a deep down difficulty in dealing with communism as a project and its authoritarian sides and its unapologetic attachment to at least the ideological lineage of the communist project back to the Russian Revolution and before. And there's an odd kind of way in which a certain sort of American conservative of the Kissinger variety, you know, who thinks of themselves as steeped in history and so on, can sort of almost deal with this more easily than American liberals can,
yeah,
who very
yeah.
quickly go to universal values and insist on their relevance, and you know, and that is their creed, and they stand by it, and I'm as attached to it as any other liberal. But it's difficult then to assimilate historical difference, particularity, differentiation within that frame, and that's a notorious problem.
You're caught on the horns of. I mean, I think intellectually, most of us, at one level. We are cultural relativists. We understand that, you know, historical forces shape the at least in a given time, the possible, you know, choices.
And this is a potent relativism. This goes back to this issue of whether Americans of any stripe can live with plurality except under the sign
right.
of dominance, right? Because this isn't just the sort of pluralism for which you make space and out of the goodness of your hearts recognize, because, and the same is true in the United States. The Black Lives Matter movement is, of course, fostered by a certain sort of American liberalism at this point, but black people remain a small minority, relatively speaking, within the United States, mm-hmm. and a disempowered one.
Yeah.
And it's quite different to deal with an absolute giant that dwarfs you, that looks as though in the foreseeable future it will be more potent. In fact, in certain dimensions, it was already vastly more potent than you are, and with regard to certain problems like climate, is the problem. And you are suddenly discover yourself as it were, an accessory to a problem which you no longer govern, and that's a even deeper challenge.
Last year, I wrote an essay after, you know, the summer of Black Lives Matter and Trump's sort of ratcheting up of the heat on China, and finding, you know, parallels between these things. I sort of saw the white American, especially male, response to Black Lives Matter as having a lot in common with what the American sort of national response to China was. I'll send you that essay. It was a lot of fun.
In my forthcoming book, Shutdown, which is out in September, I make exactly that argument.
I can't wait to read it. That'll be great.
So, because after all, just as a historian, you have to ask yourself, like, why the antagonism between China and the United States in its modern form, of course, doesn't start with Trump. We agree, you and I think, that it goes back to 2009.
Or earlier.
So the question really is, why does it explode in 2020? And part of the trigger is the pandemic as Absolutely. Such. Part of the trigger is the escalating pressure that China is applying on its side. Notably, Hong Kong is, I think, the thing which shifts in 2020. But then the question is, why is that taken up by the American side at that moment? And I completely agree that the escalating tension of the American culture war, and if it gets wrapped up with China, if you read people like Barr, like, you know, Attorney General Barr Absolutely. At the time, it's astonishing the extent to which we're in a kind of McCarthyite double front, right? Internal and external enemies, with the two being quite confused, woke Hollywood supporting both Black Lives Matter and, you know, kowtowing to the Communist Party. That's, I think, a fusion that happens within a structural configuration which makes a struggle between the United States and China more and more likely. The fact that it happens at that particular moment, I think, really does involve that kind of fusion of different strands of anxiety and tension.
I can't wait to read your book. So, you know, your paragraph, I mean, you mentioned that China today is not exporting revolution. It's not, while there's still a fear of communism, we should be clear that, and you write this, that you say it's not the China of the past. It's not sponsoring Maoist revolutions. It's not Saudi Arabia, you say, you know, with its sponsorship of Wahhabism and its destabilizing support for all sorts of radical strains. It's not Russia and its little green men in Ukraine. And I think most interestingly, you write, it's not the U.S. I mean, you wrote, I'm going to quote you here, nor is it a military hyperpower that dispatches drones to kill its enemies around the world. You mentioned the killing by the Baghdad airfield, it was 2 years ago, or engages in wars of choice and destabilizes fragile states in pursuit of responsibility to protect operations. I imagine you must have caught a little bit of flack for that last bit. You know, some people might have called you whataboutist or both sides-ism.
No, actually, I'm not. I mean, it has the merit of simply being a statement of fact.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, you can. I mean, it really is simply, and it's, I think, surprising how shocking it is to us when you just make that statement of fact, right?
Right.
And I think without wanting to sort of, you know, go down the rabbit hole of a critique of American power in the last 20 to 30 years, we should recognize how extraordinary it's been. And we are witnessing, after all, in Afghanistan now, in these weeks, as it were, the pathetic kind of full stop on one part of that project. But also, as a historian, I thought, for me, it was very important to remind folks that this isn't the first time that the world has encountered Chinese power, right? I had the privilege of being in Tanzania at the beginning of 2020, and if you go to the National Museum in Dar or somewhere like that, you see all these monuments to Tanzanian Chinese cooperation in the 1960s, building mm-hmm. tunnels. Mm-hmm. If you look at the data for Chinese capital export that Carmen Reinhart and others put together, what's really interesting is that before the big bulge of One Belt, One Road, there's actually a previous bulge of Chinese foreign investment in the 1960s.
Sure.
Which was tiny in absolute terms, but relative to Chinese GDP was already quite significant. So there have, as it were, it's worth reminding ourselves in the current moment that, in a sense, the challenge China poses now is far more conventional than the challenge that China posed in the 60s, when it was a full-on revolutionary force.
Right. It had no buy-in whatsoever to the system. In fact,
talk about Black Lives Matter. I mean, it was bought in on a rhetoric of racially coded confrontation with Western power. My old buddy at Yale, Jeremy Friedman, who's now at Harvard, has a powerful new book coming out about precisely this.
So I mentioned that you view much of what China does as, you know, par for the course for a large and powerful nation state. But does this concept of a nation state really fit for what China is today? I mean, obviously China wasn't present at Westphalia. I mean, you've heard maybe that this famous, you know, in my field anyway, a very, very well-known political scientist named Lucien Pai. He once said of China that China is a civilization masquerading as a nation state. Now, to be sure, I mean, China insists up and down that it is now absolutely a nation state. But, you know, it's hard to ignore certain aspects of Chinese behavior that don't quite conform to these ideas. I mean, the way, for example, that the party is never quite comfortable with the idea that emigre Chinese, overseas Chinese, whatever their citizenship, are still somehow theirs. They are treated differently. I know this firsthand. I mean, you know, as somebody who, even though I was born in the United States, you know, I am absolutely treated differently, and I'm regarded as being civilizationally Chinese, irrespective of, you know, what my native language is. Whether, you know, it's sometimes under the sort of benign protection, and sometimes it's under the less benign, you know, jurisdiction, but they want to impose this. So is China not like any other nation state? Just because it's bigger, as maybe your piece suggests, possibly? Or do you think there's anything to this civilization stuff? I mean, without getting all Samuel Huntington.
Oh, I was thinking, I mean, I've been thinking about this. I mean, again, it may have something to do with my background as a Germanist, because, you know, who else wasn't at Westphalia was the Germans. Now, Westphalia,
it wasn't to Germany, right?
Well, no, it was about Germany. It was made on the body of Germany.
Yeah, there was the Palatinate, Germany. And there was, you know,
there's no Germany present, right? Because the German solution is the Holy Roman Empire of German nations,
right?
And this is in no way to quibble with, obviously, the claims for the depth and the sophistication of Chinese culture as a realm. But I don't think the incongruence between nation state form and cultural sphere is unique to China. It may be particularly grandiose in the Chinese case, which would be unsurprising, but it's not. It's by no means unique. I mean, the same thing is often said about my country of birth. Like, you know, are the English really a nation, or are they basically just imperialists, right? And in which case, what are they now, since they don't have an empire and they may lose the United Kingdom? And there isn't really anyone who regards themselves as British. In fact, it's often said that the only people who regard themselves as British are, you know, say, Caribbean migrants in the post-colonial period. You wouldn't catch somebody like me describing themselves as British. It would seem presumptuous. So I think that point is best made as, you know, one which applies to the many states. In the particular instance I was using it, I think it was to a degree a polemical edge, right? I mean, back to this question of, you know, what exactly is it that irks us about China's return to scale, right? And very often in American policy discourse, I don't need to tell you right now, it's as though China was behaving in some astonishingly outrageous way, you know, and it all needs to be explained in terms of, you know, Xi and Xi's rise and this huge and sudden and abrupt rupture that happens in 2012, which means that now we're set on this course, and if only China could go back to being, and that's the question mark, what? Like, what would China have to do to calm the hawks in Washington? And I don't think there's an answer to that other than be utterly supplicant. Like, there's no configuration. And, you know, and even, you know, truly willing players in America's orbit like Japan, South Korea and Germany, if they ever show any genuine, you know, sense of autonomy, they get labeled as French. And then shortly after that, it's, you know, you're being labeled as a rogue state. So for a regime like China, I just think it's impossible. There isn't. What would they have to do to their defense budget? They would have to continuously reduce it as a share of GDP so as to keep the Pentagon happy with a ratio of like 6-1 or whatever it is would make the Pentagon happy. Right. So that's the polemical edge. I think you could also say in defense of the argument that there has been at times a project of making China into a nation state, whatever it was before, and that's obviously a contested question. The current regime is quite attached to that construction, though, as you say, it's around the edges. And then I think as a third element, I would just have to admit that no one's ever going to mistake me for a specialist in Chinese civilization. So it's the thing I understand. When the Chinese are acting like a nation state, it registers on my radar.
Like, right. And when they're not, it may escape you. But the more interesting question is what we were just talking about, what you had already drifted into, which was, you know, really the last thing that I wanted to bring up with you, which is, of course, is there a possible scenario, and you've already sort of answered that, in which the Americans can accept a multipolar reality in which China is a peer state? And I mean, I think that the anxieties just seems to stem from that. I mean, it is sort of a psychological difficulty on the part of the Americans to accept China as a near peer competitor. There may be, as I've talked about before, you know, a racial element in it. There may be, it may not exist, but I mean, I think we'd have to answer a kind of counterfactual, you know, if Poland were suddenly to become, you know, a near peer competitor, would its being white somehow diminish American anxiety over its rise? And I'm inclined to think that, yes, it would diminish it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to... I don't know the answer to that question. That is, I think, the huge challenge for American politics. It's the project, you know, and creating the basis on which one could at least have that conversation is, I imagine, one of the things that unites folks like you and me in wanting to push this conversation and push the conversation in the way in which we do, in the only hope for that, presumably, is on the basis of mutual comprehension. And the current situation is truly alarming, because it seems to be shutting the doors to that and to be retreating in some sense. I mean, you know, and I do think there is a degree of parallelism here, though I don't want to push it too far, you know, into sort of mutual stereotyping of various types, which is profoundly unproductive.
Yeah.
But I, to be honest, don't have a clear idea. We don't. I mean, after all, we certainly, both you and I, have lived our entire lives, and indeed at least one or two generations before us, under the sign of American dominance. And it is very difficult to imagine a world which isn't like that. I mean, I don't think the future, I don't think sensible money bets on a future of Chinese dominance, but multipolarity is already our reality.
Right.
And the question is really how tense it's going to be.
It's even more worrisome for me now that nationalism in China itself has changed. I read an excellent essay just yesterday in The Wire China by Alec Ash, who happens to be Timothy Garton Ash's son, who's lived in China since 2008. He wrote this essay talking about how the old reactive nationalism that used to define China, that was defensive, that was mostly just about sort of China not getting a fair shake, about, you know, being misrepresented in the media, it's completely changed. It is now much more. It's not just defiant. It comes from confidence and not from a place of sort of, you know, inferiority complex. It now says, I have something to tell you. Yeah. I have something, and that's what changed, you know, beginning in 2009. I mean, I used to write about, you know, Chinese nationalism being more or less of the you know, garden variety reactive nationalist sort. I said, look, it lacks the kind of viciousness of, you know, a Hindutva or Russian nationalism, because it doesn't have a religious core around which to cohere, for one thing. And I feel like I have to revisit my thinking on this, and in light of Alec's excellent essay. I mean, he really talks about a new form of nationalism that's taken over. He also writes quite a bit about sort of the performative aspects of it, but how, you know, the performance actually becomes the belief. You know, Václav Havel's essay about, you know, the greengrocer and the sign that says "Workers of the World Unite." It's a very good essay, and I highly recommend it. Speaking of recommendations, we should get on to recommendations. But first, let me thank you, Adam. This was just such a pleasure to talk to you. Before we do, I want you to plug Chartbook, your excellent Substack, and talk about what the conceit of this latest endeavor is. Tell them where they can find it.
Yeah, so I've joined the folks on Substack. I've been doing it for about 9 months now, and
it's great.
It's a space for me to explore things, actually, to just answer questions that I'm interested in. I've done a couple on Afghanistan, and again, no one's going to mistake me for an Afghanistan specialist, but it's just on my mind right now. I can't watch what's happening without having a bunch of questions. But it's also a space for sort of meta-reflection, for thinking about theory. I've in my academic life pursued a lot of different avenues simultaneously, and that's left me with a huge number of questions about how to tie things together. And, you know, I'm spoiled. I publish all over the place, but much of that is too personal in a sense, just a little bit too amateurish, even for my self-confidence, to want to, like, you know, to put it, to foist it on a proper publication. So this has been a really great space, and it's a good community to be in. I get a lot of great conversations that spiral out of it. So yes, if folks are interested in this, it's Chartbook at Substack. Come along. I'm posting once a week, basically, and those who subscribe get, like, you know, kind of links 2 or 3 times a week. So it's really fun.
It is really great stuff. I've really been enjoying it. All right. Before we go on to recommendations, I just want to do a quick reminder that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. If you like what we're doing with this show and with the other shows in our network, please remember that the best way to support us is with a subscription to SupChina Access, our daily email newsletter, which is really, really just full of, you know, all the important news from China from an unimaginably vast array of news sources. So subscribe to us, show your support. We work very, very hard on this. So recommendations, Adam, what you got for us?
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So it's something weighty, but it is perhaps the most impressive thing I've read in years. It's Vasily Grossman's double novel about Stalingrad. Mm. I wrote about this on the chart book because I just had to somehow work it out in my mind emotionally. It's this monumental two-volume novel, historical novel, that's explicitly based on Tolstoy's War and Peace about Stalingrad, the build-up to the Stalingrad battle and then the battle itself. It runs to over 2,000 pages, but you know, I mean, I wanted more at the end of it all. The volume that's well known in the West has been for decades. It's a sort of dissident classic, is Life and Fate.
Right.
But actually, to understand Life and Fate, I would strongly recommend everyone to start with the book, which has been translated quite recently simply as Stalingrad, which is the precursor. And the two together are about as epic a piece of, I think of them as incredibly serious history writing, to be honest, thinking and reflection on what it means to live history. This is not something that he did as a potboiler. He was one of the bravest war correspondents of the Red Army. He put his life at risk continuously. He was reprimanded, in fact, for the risk that he took. He was in the city itself at the time of the fighting. So it's as a vivid and dramatic account of the war in all its complexity. Grossman was Jewish. His mother was killed in a death pit in the Ukraine in 1941. So it's a shattering account of the violence of the mid-20th century on the Eastern Front.
Adam, when you say that it's inspired explicitly by Tolstoy, do you mean that sort of in its historiography? You know, because Tolstoy has those wonderful appendices in is that what you mean?
It's simultaneously a novel, a history, and also a meta reflection on what history is, and for a professional academic historian, humbling in its sophistication and plasticity and the multivocal way in which Grossman is able to summon this question, including the question that everyone at the time, you know, in his clique, they were all reading. He spent, the only book he read throughout the war was Tolstoy, so Tolstoy inserts himself into Grossman's thinking of the war. It's dizzying as a book, unforgettable.
I think that I'm going to put the podcast on pause for a couple of weeks and just spend those reading this. I had not heard a more compelling pitch for a book in quite some time, and I'm kind of ready to read something like that right now. And my recommendation is going to sound so utterly frivolous by comparison, which is just a show that I've been watching on Amazon Prime called The Legend of El Cid, which is a Spanish language series. It's the second season. The first season was really short and not entirely satisfying, but it's a real improvement on the old 1961 Charlton Heston movie, which I loved as a kid, you know. But if you can get past the title character's mullet, which he sports for much of the first season, I think you're going to love it. It's just all sorts of, you know, it's bloody battles and gratuitous nude scenes and of course, lots and lots of, you know, court intrigue and betrayal and, you know, noble moors and, you know, the whole thing you get with the El Cid package. But it's great. I mean, I love how fight choreography has gotten to the point right now where you're never embarrassed watching these, you know, these epic medieval battles on premium cable. So check it out, El Cid. Enjoy that. A very sorry follow-up to your excellent recommendation, Adam. Adam, thanks once again. It's just been such a hoot. A real pleasure. I'm looking forward to publishing this one enormously.
Great. Look forward to the next time.
Okay, great. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced and edited by me, Kaiser Guo. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at @SubChinaNews, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.